to illustrate that, as I see it anyway, the whole area of discussion and debate is a very complex one through which we can only pick our way with very great care, and that I am very suspicious when I am presented with stark antitheses which say it is either this or that. So that my plea on these grounds and on other grounds is simply that we should try and hold these two worlds in tension. The theological on the one hand, about which we agree, the scientific on the other, about which we differ. And I have no desire to suggest that the creationist position is scientifically untenable. I believe, as Arthur does, that it has a large number of difficulties attaching to it from a scientific point of view. And I cannot turn round and say, no, that is completely out of court, it is completely untenable. Indeed, I would go beyond that. And I would welcome attempts to examine alternative ideas to evolutionary ideas from a scientific point of view. On the other hand, having said that, I think that it is also very difficult, particularly on theological grounds, to rule out evolution. Now, this is a theme which evolution in a biological scientific sense, not evolution in a cosmic philosophical sense. And I would wish to make that particular plea. I said I would say something about the pastoral problem. Maybe that will come out in discussion, but I would like just to make one observation. The view of nature, which is adopted by atheist and agnostic evolutionists, is a simple one. It is that the patterns that we see are only apparent order. They are at root the product of the selection of random changes by environmental factors. And the key word in that statement is the random. Because if that basic idea is accepted, then it follows that the very ideas which the evolutionist himself is presenting are ideas which are the product at root, not of order, but of randomness, because, according to him, there is nothing more, nothing outside that random process and that process of chance selection. And the end point of that, from the point of view of the ordinary human being living his life in Western civilization in 1980, is that in the world there is no meaning, there is no purpose, there is no morality. And there is no challenge, and as I understand it, the only possible course of action is either to do absolutely nothing or else to commit suicide. Because we are simply, and nothing more, than accidents of chance in a universe which is completely meaningless. And I am convinced in dealing with students that one of the ways of dealing with the current worship of evolution is in fact to press that kind of argument and point out to them where it leads in terms of personal living, in the terms of living an ordinary life, and to present the challenge in that way. rather than to approach it from another point of view and to look at the scientific and try to remove the supposed scientific basis for the idea, which is in fact one of the stronger points in the kind of argument that is made. And I, for one, find that the only alternative to that view is one which gives a full place to revelation, and therefore a full place to God's revelation in Scripture. And that, in fact, leads me to my last point, which again I raise in passing in my paper. On the one hand, as a practicing scientist, I am confronted with a world which is complex, which is very rich, which is ultimately, I'm quite convinced, beyond my full understanding. I can try to understand some parts of it, and my fellow scientists can try to understand other parts, and we can try and build up science some kind of picture. A picture which, in my view, has some real credibility, if not final truth. On the other hand, when I come to God's revelation in the other and more important book, the Scriptures, as I study and the more I try to work out the implications for me of the grand doctrines which are taught there, the more beyond me that appears to be also, and my attitude to that can only be humble capitulation. And for those reasons, I feel that we have to, not exactly reserve judgment, but hold two rather different viewpoints in tension and work out their pastoral implications rather than getting down to the discussion and examination of theological niceties. Thank you.
I wouldn't know, but I would be inclined to think that nowhere, maybe in the world, would we have gained in an hour and a half, little over an hour and a half, so much in such a short compass of time. How much each has taken in will depend upon their knowledge and capacity. But I'm sure that all of us, even those least knowledgeable in some of those fields, will feel that we have gained a very, very great deal, and that the whole thing has been presented in a gracious and charitable fashion, and that's perhaps more important than is indeed more important in our gathering of brothers, and no one would be in the slightest doubt at all that these three fellows are loving brothers in the Lord, as surely we all are. I think now, therefore, it would be right for these three chaps to speak a little to one another, and I leave them absolutely to decide how they would do that.
Would we give you a
There is another aspect of this, in what I was saying, I did mention and imply that, of course, philosophical considerations do affect not only the way scientists work, but also the kinds of conclusion which they prefer and the kinds of methods that they choose and things of this kind. Also, it is undoubtedly true that there are sociological dimensions to this as well, and that there is a very considerable group influence on the kinds of result that are accepted and so on. Now, this is something which the creationist viewpoint makes quite a lot of. And I think it would be helpful if I asked Nigel to expand a little on this, because I do think that this is another point where we differ a little.
Yes. My feeling, I mean, as I say, I'm not in any way scientifically qualified, but as I understand from my scientific friends, it is not at all as simple as indeed the speakers have said this morning. It isn't at all as simple as when we were at school we were led to believe it was, that scientists discover things and that they're true, and that, you know, you have to face it, and that's all there is to it. But in fact, science takes place within a community, and scientists tend to conform to a certain way of understanding things. And the man who doesn't conform tends to get rather short shrift. I don't know if any of you heard one of the science programs on the radio a couple of months ago, in which an immunologist from Australia called Ted Steele, I think, who has produced some rather startling results, apparently, connected with the mechanism of evolution. In that he espouses a Lamarckian view of the way the thing works, whereby acquired characteristics can be inherited. Darwin said that this was a sort of minor theme to the thing, but since Darwin's day, most scientists have said this is not on. Now, this man has apparently produced some results to show that in the case of mice or rats or whatever he was dealing with, a certain acquired characteristics can be passed on from one generation to, I think, three generations. He's tested. And he's produced results, published a book, and published a paper on the subject. Now, they interviewed a number of distinguished men of science from this country in this broadcast. And first of all, they had a couple of men who were saying this was a very interesting idea, and if it were right, it would help to explain some of the problems in the mechanism of evolution. But then they had another man, I forget his name, meant to be a very distinguished man in the field, and he said some astonishing things about this man Steele and his results. His final comment was, "I'll be very surprised if this man believes his own nonsense in a year's time." And before then he had said that one of two things must be the case: either the man is ignorant or he's faking his results, because the conclusions he's come to simply are not possible. And it seems to me that was something of an eye-opener to the kind of way in which a scientific fraternity operates, at least in certain regards. Now, of course, I'm sure this man will be an exception in a certain respect, but the problem is that scientists do have to conform. And I'm sure it's very difficult. I mean, I have friends who have changed their minds about this question of whether evolution is true in the course of a scientific career, when they have been research students or when they have been lecturers. And it is exceedingly difficult to do so, as it would be for, I suppose, someone to become an evangelical after he was already a minister. You can see the kind of pressures and the kind of change of worldview which is required. And it's no surprise to me that men who have been brought up and trained and schooled in an evolutionary science come to evolutionary conclusions. And it seems to me that one must be very sceptical of the claim that this is an orthodox approach, that everyone who's anybody agrees with it, and that therefore it's right. And I think that modern sociologists of science and philosophers of science have become increasingly aware of, if you like, the relativity of scientific conclusions, and of the way in which they can be so influenced by the presuppositions of the community which is doing the work. And therefore, it doesn't surprise me that scientists tend to say, well, this is nonsense, and the evidence is all the other way. And as I was suggesting, there are certainly well-qualified men, as it happens, who would say the same thing, only putting the boot on the other foot. And it is certainly very difficult for me, and I'm sure for many of you, to know what to make of that kind of debate, which is why I stick to theology. And I think if I could just briefly say that it seems to me that there is a certain rationale in doing that. Because I think as a matter of epistemology, the way that we come to knowledge as Christians, we do have to start with Scripture. And, I mean, historically, modern science has developed upon the basis of the scriptural view of the world. And it seems to me entirely reasonable that we should say that if Scripture says this must be so or this cannot be so, to bring that knowledge over into our scientific work is an entirely proper procedure. And this is what creationists, so-called, have been saying. And I think it is a reasonable thing to do. And I think that this relates to what Roland Moss was saying about the two worlds. And it seems to me I don't believe in these two worlds, the theological world and the world of science. It seems to me that when people say that, the implication, though they maybe don't feel this, the implication is that the theological world is somehow a mythological world. It's concerned with values at the end of the day and not with the real world. Whereas the centre of history is the cross of Christ. And the cross of Christ is a man dying, physically dying, in our place. And it seems to me that that, if nothing else, tells us that the two worlds are the one world, that physical death and that the moral theological significance of death must at the end of the day be united. And so that we can't divorce the worlds, and that the evidence which I have presented in my paper is directly relevant to the scientific evidence, and the two can't be forced apart ultimately.
Can I just raise one or two points from that, Nigel? I quite agree that that science did spring, the scientific enterprise did spring from a Christian approach to the scriptures. I think it's an interesting historical point which should be borne in mind is that a belief in a very old world was held by evangelical Christian scientists long before Darwin. I think that's a very important point to make. I think too much is made of Darwin. Evolution was talked about scores of years before Darwin, as you know, and certainly, as in the case of Sedgwick, who was really, I think, a man of real Christian conviction. I'm very impressed with his writings. He certainly would regard his geology, his geological investigations, as an intensely religious and Christian activity. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, as I say, believed in a world which had a very long and complicated history. But a more important question, but I come to a key question, because I think the point is that you on your side, if you like, those of you who are concerned with the preaching of the Word of God and applying it in a pastoral sense, are faced with a problem of a very similar kind to a Christian geologist like myself, who firmly believe that I've been called by God into this particular discipline and into this particular activity. I think those who know me would recognize that. That's yes. The fact. And, I mean, the key question is this. How do I teach my geology if I seek to interpret it in a manner consistent with a literal reading of Genesis 1? I mean, I must distinguish between facts and the conclusions of which you speak, and I agree, but I think it is important to recognize that there's an enormous body of facts, and that's quite different from any interpretation that is made concerning it. Now, of course, I recognize that you, on the other side, are faced with precisely the same problem. How do I preach Genesis 1 to 3? Do I seek to interpret it in the light of what the scientific facts are and some of the impossible interpretations? I would like to know an answer to this, really, from you, Nigel, if it's possible to... I know it's a difficult question to put, certainly just off the cuff, it might be difficult to answer, although you may have an answer for it. But I mean, just how do I approach the teaching of my subject in a way that is gives full integrity to the text?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't presume to tell you how to do your job. But I think that the principle, I mean, I'm convinced of the principle because, I mean, in my own academic work, it is exactly the same problem. In the next 6 months, I have, this is on tape, isn't it? I have to produce a thesis conclusion, which is acceptable to my conscience and to my examiners. And the two may not see things the same way. And I would see this in the context of the way in which every Christian, particularly every Christian academic or intellectual, has somehow to come to terms with working within a secular university or a secular intellectual environment and as a Christian. And I think that there are tensions built in whatever we are doing. And I'm sure you would agree with that. I mean, in the broader questions of the philosophy of science, that this is inevitable.
The thing is that, I mean, you say that in a secular society, but in fact I'm believing much the same as in, say, Sedgwick did. When the society was not secular, when geology was still regarded as very much a Christian activity. You see, this is the problem, isn't it? That, our society now is secular. It's atheistic, if you like. Its whole ethos is that. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that what I'm teaching in no way contradicts those views of geology, which was held before Darwin. Not really in principle.
Oh, I quite accept that, and I mean, I think what you were saying a little before is an interesting comment that creationists and the American flood geologists, and I mean, I hold no brief for them, though I mean, a number so amongst my friends, but these men are not simply harking back to early 19th century geology. They are embarking on what is in many ways a completely novel course in wanting an Earth 10,000 years old, and I mean, and I quite accept that. I think that's quite a significant factor. That they aren't simply wanting the good old days, they're wanting something which is new. But that in Sedgwick's day, I mean, even Lyell, in his Principles of Geology, felt he had to spend several pages discussing the flood, I mean, the flood of Noah, and showing how the scriptural evidence was compatible with his view of historical geology. And it seems to me, I mean, then, you could use scriptural evidence in discussing geology in a university. And the point is that now you can't, because the universities have become more and more secularized. And it seems to me that there is an inbuilt tension, I mean, in this girl doing her fine history of art. She has to cope with a Marxist department. And that there's a fundamental secular bias now in the university, in this country. It may be, I mean, I definitely believe that we should be working towards Christian institutions and setting up a Christian university. And Christian schools, and I mean, of course, this is very, very controversial ground. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that biblical learning is going to have a hard time of it. Biblically based Christian learning is going to have a hard time of it in a secular society, increasingly. And although, of course, in an area like geology, as in an area like, for instance, the Old Testament, a university lecturer, if he is going to adopt the kind of views on both that I would hold, is going to find going very difficult indeed. And I'm not suggesting it's easy, but it seems to me there's no neutrality, there's no neutral ground. And there are the facts, and you must deal with the facts, but that taking a different view from the view of Wickham and Morris, say, is not to go into neutrality, it's to go into an alternative view, which I would believe is fundamentally based upon an atheist set of presuppositions. And I mean, you wouldn't, and I quite respect that. But there is no neutral ground you can work from, and somehow Christians have to fight it out. I mean, does that answer?
Well, in part, yes. I think that, you know, the Pitcomb and Morris is not novel, because, in fact, it was the universally held view, well, the commonly held view, before, say, Hutton, prior to more, you know, the rise of geology. Although, again, as I think I mentioned in conversation either with you or someone else, that it is interesting that interpretation of the days of Genesis 1, you know, was a talking point long before geology was ever thought of you know, Josephus himself thought in metaphorical, and certainly there were others long before, hundreds of years before geology began, who thought that the days of Genesis 1 were not to be taken in a literal sense. That's one point I would make. But again, I think that, you see, you mentioned this student in the history of art. And I agree, I mean, this is a very alarming thing about our universities, that so much of the teaching is done through that. But it's important to see, in fact, that it's the way in which they, A, select the facts of history and then interpret them. It's not the facts themselves which are in question. And that's precisely what we are faced with, you see, here in the science. I mean, I can certainly see things which are factual. And the facts themselves, it's the facts which come into conflict with a literal reading of Genesis 1, not my interpretation of it. And that's really what I'm trying to get at. How, in fact, do I get round this? Because I want to be a thoroughgoing Christian in my geology. I want to be able to teach my geology to my students in such a way that I give full glory to God. And I, you know, that is my calling.
Can I put in, by literal, you mean 24-hour days, is that what you're talking
about? 24-hour days, yes. In other words, going back to what was the pre-modern geology concept, you know, that which was the generally accepted. But you see, Darwin, just coming back to this historical point, to me, Darwin was the point when, in fact, religion was separated, or at least science, the scientific activity of men was separated from its religious foundations. But I mean, the ideas, such as an ancient era, a very complex history. And in fact, I think Dr. Pye Smith, and Edward Hitchcock, and others, believed that there was no evidence for the flood on the Earth's surface. And I mean, that was in a time before that took place. You know, this is an interesting historical point, I think a very important one as well.
Yes, sorry. No, carry on.
I said too much.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, if you find that what you regard as facts are in conflict with a certain reading of Genesis, I mean, I can't solve the problem. I would not want to defend what you call a literal reading of Genesis 1, 24-hour days. I would incline to such a view. I would look to literary arguments for and against. And I do not believe everything in the Bible is literal in that sense. I mean, in the paper I pointed out at the beginning that there are two ways in which you can use the word literal. And I am desperate to recover what it was the human author thought he was saying. Because if we can discover that, then I will stand by that. Though, I mean, you know, what was it the Jesuits used to say, the Catholic Church teach that black is white, I will believe it. And if the Bible teaches that black is white, you know, I'll believe it. The point is you must establish this on proper exegetical grounds. And, I mean, Augustine believed that the earth wasn't made in 6 days. He believed the earth was made instantaneously. And this was a didactic device.
But also he believed in a gap, didn't he?
Did he?
I think so.
Oh, well, maybe, I don't know. But the point seems to me to be that you must establish on exegetical grounds, and I would hope we might come to an agreement on the fact that if something can be established exegetically, even though it relates to historical geology or to the creation of the moon or anything else, that this is a starting point for Christians involved in science.
Well, that's fine, because in fact the problem is handed over to all of you who are in theology. Well, this is precisely what we need, you see. And I think that there are aspects of the exegesis of Genesis 1 to 3 which need to be looked at. I was mentioning one coming up on the train with Peter and Alan there. You know, how is it, I mean, what do we make of the fact that the Garden of Eden has gates and a wall round it? What on earth does that mean? How are we to conceive of that? That's something that I have not seen expanded. And also, of course, the fact that the angels guarding the gate are always subsequently found in the scriptures to be in the heavenlies, you know, in heaven. You know, there are aspects about that. And also that verse in Genesis 1, let the earth bring forth, right? Let the earth bring forth. All sorts of exegetical matters of that kind which I think need careful attention to. Now, whether you believe that we should taken to due cognizance, the scientific evidence, the geological evidence, as another matter. You may feel that you shouldn't, and I would quite respect that. But again, I still want to have the answer from, you know, the theologians, the Christian theologians, as to where I am wrong, if at all, you know, in the way that I teach geometry. You know, in other words, as I say, I feel myself that we have to approach nature and the scriptures with the same childlike submission. What is this? What are the facts of the case? Should we attempt to relate them? I don't know.
You have Keble's hymn about nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, well, again, what I want to say at this point arises out of what Nigel said right at the very, very beginning of the discussion when I asked him the initial question. And I too am going to begin with a story.
Yes, speak up.
Sorry. I said I too am going to begin with a story. When not long before I left Birmingham, Duane Gish, who is an eminent American creationist, was invited by Campus Crusade to Birmingham University to give a lecture on the creationist point of view. And this was circularized, and I believe he had quite a good audience. I had a Senate meeting or one of these other responsibilities that professors in universities have which prevent them doing much more interesting things. And I spoke to some of my friends in the biology department, members of staff, admittedly junior members of staff. I don't think any of the biology professors went, but some of the junior members of staff went. And I spoke to them afterwards and said, what did they think of the lecture? And they said, well, of course, we didn't agree with it, but we were jolly glad that somebody came and put that point of view, because we believe that our students have got to learn to think flexibly, and they've got to learn to ask questions about the things that they believe to be true. And that, I must confess, is my experience of a large number of scientists on this particular issue, that they are prepared, certainly today, in a way that they were not 20, 30 years ago, to maintain an open mind on this particular issue of biological evolution in its historical dimension.
Would you say that? And your experience?
Yes. Oh, I think that's very much the case. Yes, that's right.
With regard to the two worlds which Nigel mentioned. Now, I was very careful not to speak about two worlds. I did speak about two rather different activities, and I tried to make clear in what sense I was using the word activity. I was using the word activity in terms of a form of thinking, not in terms of different bodies of knowledge in that sense, totally separate. And I was trying to point out that looking at the world which we experience, and I instanced death, there are all sorts of questions that you can ask about that particular phenomenon with which we are all familiar, which is death. And I was trying to point out that the theologian is asking rather different questions about death from the kind of questions that the biologist asks about death. And consequently, because they are asking different questions, they are getting rather different answers. But I did point out that there is an overlap between these two. And I was not saying that we can put science on one side and theology on the other and pursue them as though they were not related to one another. I did say that there was an overlap, but I was trying to emphasize that the questions relating to the overlap between two different fields, such as theology and science, had to be very carefully thought through and formulated because they were complex by virtue of the rather different questions that the two groups of people were asking. Now, this is something which occurs not only in relation to theology and philosophy on the one hand and science on the other, but it is something which occurs in science itself. It occurs even considering a young earth and an old earth, a developmental idea of origins or a sudden idea of origins. When we're trying to pinpoint the precise contradictions, the precise antitheses between the two, we are confronted with much the same problem that, as I believe Nigel would point out, the kind of thinking that leads to the questions that are asked is rather different. But having come to that point and thought that through, the actual comparison of the two in terms of the observations or the experiment that you conduct is then a test which is quite independent of the origins of the questions. Sorry if I'm being technical, but this is a problem that we confront not simply as scientists or Christians, but as scientists. And this is one reason why for very long periods in the history of science, rival theories have held the field. And it is only when someone of some considerable brilliance, usually, comes along and formulates the questions in such a way that a test can be devised which enables you to distinguish between the two, that one is rejected and another is accepted, at least for the time being. I'm not arguing for two worlds or putting in knowledge into separate compartments at all, but I am arguing that human intellectual activity is a very complex thing, and that in science, at least, or in some sciences anyway, over a process of time, ways of formulating questions and devising tests have been developed which give a very high degree of plausibility to the kinds of conclusion that are reached. Now, whether that is true in terms of some kind of spontaneous generation versus development in science is another question which we could talk about in more detail, but I certainly would maintain, and in fact do in my lectures to my students on the philosophy of science, maintain a viewpoint which insists that that knowledge is an interrelated unity. Are we expected to go on to 1 o'clock?
Are you tired?
As Arthur's telephone bill and my telephone bill bear eloquent testimony, we can go on for hours.
Well, I mean, in response to that, I mean, if we are talking about one world, it seems to me the fundamental problem arises in my understanding of Genesis, not as to whether it's literal or not, because that is something to be settled by Old Testament scholars, and in a sense it is almost irrelevant. Genesis 1 to 3 could all be a fairy tale from a literary point of view, and I think that my argument would still stand about what it was teaching us about man. And the fundamental problem for me is, if indeed the Bible is speaking about this world and about real men when it says that death, a physical thing, in man is evil and not natural and something which is caused by sin, which is a theological moral thing, then the worlds meet there. And it seems to me that it's as soon as you admit that, that the problem that I've tried to expound arises, and that it is ways of getting round that, ultimately, it seems to me, force the worlds apart, or if you like, divide the world into these two. The sort of theological up in the air, which is really a world of values, and rather than realities, and the real world that we live in. And I think that the Bible speaks about the two as being joined together, both in the origin of sin and in its being done away with in Christ.
I was surprised to feel that I disagreed with you to some extent later on at Nigel. You spoke about man made in a perfect world, and I instantly thought of Genesis 3:1, the serpent. Certainly, a perfect world, but evil in some form present before that. The whole question of the angelic creation, when and thereafter. Now the serpent.
For example, we use the word perfect. Mm-hmm. And the word perfect doesn't occur in Genesis 1:3. The phrase is very good. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious, I think, from God's placing of man in creation, that his job is, partly at least, the perfection of creation. So we speak about the world being perfect, we perhaps mislead ourselves. I think it's legitimate to start with the world being very good in its creation. But where I think that I think the world has to be different.
With respect to that, I ask you to pursue your question with another.
Yes, I don't see a difficulty there at all between good and very good and perfect in that context, but never mind that.
Well, of course, the question of the origin of evil is one of the great theological biblical problems which the Bible doesn't answer.
Thomas Stoddard says we shouldn't inquire into.
Does he? Oh, well, that's it. We'll move on. For once, I'm grateful to the man. It seems to me that certainly the presence of the serpent as one of the created creatures, but as one who is set apart from them by being more subtle, whatever that is meant to mean, and by either representing or incarnating Satan, that this raises a fundamental problem for all kinds of things. And my concern principally is that in our exegesis of Genesis 1-3, we shouldn't allow the tail to wag the dog, and that we must proceed from the known to the unknown. And it seems to me that although that is true, and there are other similarly puzzling and almost anomalous aspects of the narrative, that we must approach them by means of what is made very clear. And I think that certain things are made very clear, one of which is that whether we use the word perfect, which I accept could be misleading, or whether we stick to a simple translation of the Hebrew, six times good, seventh time very good, first of all, we have creation made absolutely as God intended it to be. If you want to define sin as something that God doesn't intend to be, creation was everything that sin is not. It was what God intended it to be. And that in Genesis 1, beginning of Genesis 2, there is no indication of anything which is out of place. It is all as God wanted it, and as one day it will be restored to be. If you want to use this idea of the will of God and the intention of God as a moral arbiter. That is one thing which I think is made abundantly clear, and what I pointed out in the paper was that, interestingly, that the sevenfold goodness is not directly related to the seven-day structure. It's independent of it. You have two goods on two different days, and you have no goods on two other days, if you see what I mean. And I find that's a very significant literary factor, which you discover on looking at it. The goodness is there, and it's not simply a product of the seven-day structure of the narrative. And the other thing which is made abundantly clear, at least to me, is that throughout Scripture, the relation of the devil to the created order, as in the world, maybe the created universe, is via man. And this is what I touched on before. And I think this is clear at various points. It's clear from the structure of Genesis 1 and 2 in having man, as we say, the high priest of creation, certainly the high point of creation, man made to rule over creation, set above the animals, he names the animals, set up above all the other orders, and given dominion over them. And it's only by knocking at his door that the devil can gain access to that which is his.
Wait a moment now. Are you saying, that, therefore, that man brought down the devil and not the other way around?
Oh, no. No, I'm saying that the devil gained access into the world apart from man and into man through Adam's sin. I mean, that is what Paul says, that by one man's sin entered the world. By one man.
Yes.
And that it was only through that one man that sin could enter the world. And had Adam said no, sin would not have entered the world. And the serpent would have crawled away, and the devil would have been driven from the scene.
Do you believe then in the priority
Adam
of the...
Even if Adam has said no to the devil, you still have the fact of the devil as an objective fact, other than man.
Oh, yes.
A fact that you said a moment ago that you are not prepared... Adam has said no to the devil, you still have the fact of the devil as an objective fact, other than man.
Oh, yes.
A fact that you said a moment ago that you are not prepared to try to explain. But this is the kind of thing that you would challenge the scientists about. If they're going to talk about things that they're going to try to explain, and you criticize them for that, then you've got to try to explain this external fact other than man. This thing, it, him, whatever it is, that gained entrance into a particular part of the great order of the universe through man.
Do you believe in the priority of the angelic, the creation of angels?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Yes.
And therefore the angelic fall, at some point, where do you set that?
I don't know. It seems to me that it was very likely before the creation of the world.
So there was evil in the universe?
There was evil in the unseen universe. It's very difficult to pin the scriptures down and to use our terms and to get our terms to apply to scriptural terms. But it seems to me that the Bible, in using words like world, tends to mean the physical created world rather than the spiritual.
The universe. Yeah.
Unseen spiritual world. Yeah. And by the world, I think it means the stars and so on and all the rest of it. It didn't see these as being independent sort of worlds of their own. So as being part of the earth's world, and that it was over all of them. I mean, of course, God didn't place Adam over the stars and the suns and give him dominion over them.
But the interest is
in the earth specifically.
Psalm 8 seems to go beyond that to all things.
Yes, yes.
You're now talking about at least two different kinds of worlds. Which is the very thing that you can grow on up for being effective. talking about the world in terms of the earth. are we going out into universe space? I don't know, I'm not a scientific man at all. Some people don't think I'm a theologian either. But there are facts, you see. This fact, something other than what we have. Man, fair enough, we've got man. But then something else gains entrance into the setup through man. Now, we've got to allow for this something else, this something other. And if this is something that we cannot explain, then the same reservations that we postulate with regard to the scientist, it must apply to ourselves.
Yes, I will happily answer that. Insofar as I can. I'm not saying that we can't explain, therefore I will discuss the presence of the devil in the garden and what happened. What I am saying is that I don't think we should confuse this argument with the argument about the origin of evil in the first place, because that is a largely speculative philosophical argument which the Bible doesn't deal with. And we have hints. We don't have answers. And it seems to me that we can say things that make sense about this particular subject of what Genesis 3 is talking about in relation to sin and man and death and the world without speculating into where the serpent came from.
But you mustn't use the word speculative simpliciter when you have, you use the word hints, and I like that word, but surely some of the hints are significant hints.
Oh, indeed. I mean, that is why they're there. But it seems to me that the relation of the devil to the world over which Adam was set, which it seems to me is the world of our experience, is a relation which could only be through Adam, which is why Adam was picked on and attacked. And tempted. And we don't know what would have happened, fair enough. We don't know if he'd said no. The point is he said yes, and it was through him that sin entered the world. And as Romans 8 says, it wasn't simply the world of the man and his wife. It was the whole world over which he'd been set. And Romans 8 speaks about the whole creation and uses the word ktisis, which the commentators seem to think means the world apart from man, the lower orders of the world,
yes,
has all gone wrong because of the man. And passages like Isaiah 11 speak of, and Romans 8 speak of the restoration of all things in the creation apart from man, again because of the man. In that things will be set to rights through the same man through whom they were set wrong. And Christ comes to live as a man and to die as a man, as the last Adam, to set this right, because it's only through man as the head of creation that creation can be brought back.
But you seem to be separating worlds. You see, even the stars are not pure in his sight, and the angels, wherever they were created, they are part of the created world. They are creatures.
The creation, as we have talked about it just now, must still be set in the context of something that is actually greater than this terrestrial scene.
Oh, certainly, certainly, certainly.
The restitution, whatever that means, of all things, somehow or other has to be allied to 2 Peter 3 and the creation of a new heavens and a new earth.
Precisely.
It seems to be something completely different from what we're dealing with now. And therefore the straightforward theological proposition that you're stating and defending so well has other overtones without which this present limited discussion can't really be just totally dogmatic. This is the same as we're saying to the scientists.
Can I carry George's point even farther? Isaiah 11, Isaiah 65, and passage from Peter, the end of Revelation, as George points out, speak of a new heavens and a new earth, and the lion laying down with the lamb, and all this is in the context of the new heavens and the new earth. And I can see no biblical warrant for supposing that new heavens and that new earth, and therefore the lion and the lamb and so on, is simply a restitution of what was there at the beginning. I think it is something more.
Like a resurrection body.
And I think that this is borne out by the fact that Christ's resurrection body, which in some real sense, which we cannot understand, was a physical body, but certainly a body which was very different from the one that we had, is the earnest of the new body that his own will have at the resurrection, and that itself is the earnest of the restitution and the perfection over and above what was before of the new heavens and the new earth.
Now, I'm watching the time, and I think we should stop a little before it's 1:05. I was just going to say that I could see at one point a forest of hands. I would appeal, we've the whole of the afternoon to this, I would appeal to chaps not to draw red herrings and to drive us away out to two extremes. Let's keep as far as possible to the central point of man and the creation of man and the fall, this whole area. This is what we as practical teachers of the word are concerned with, it seems to me, in our ministry, and we must keep at that and wrestle with that. So will you please let it, peripheral issues can be discussed perhaps later on, but further in.
Well, perhaps everybody remembers what I said.
No, I don't. Have you forgotten?
No. It was quite deliberate to have it at that stage, though, just before we finished. Well, I was just, it is speculation, and I feel myself, I agree entirely with Nigel about the great danger of entering into speculative things and hardening them into dogmas, as it were. I simply raised the point that it seems to me that in the scriptures that redemption from evil was in the heart and mind of God before the creation, however we understand it. And I hope without in any sense sowing any wrong thoughts, I just wonder whether that element was present in the thinking of God as far as the creation is concerned. It's simply to bear on this very vexed question of evil and the existence of evil. I've been mentioning to one or two, and I think really I've got perhaps what is the answer to my question here, about a series of parallel statements that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 15. Remember the passage well, I'm sure, but he's drawing the contrast between Adam and Christ. And we could take it up. At verse 44. If you've got the NIV, in fact, the paragraph section begins in the middle of verse 44. But again, I'm really wanting to mention this so that those of you who are far better equipped to interpret these scriptures can provide their meaning. But Paul says here, if there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural, and after that, the spiritual. The first man, the natural man, was of the dust of the earth. The second man, from heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. That includes all of us. And as is the man from heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the likeness of the earthly man, so shall we bear the likeness of the man from heaven. Now, I read this with this question in mind about whether Adam was immortal when he was created. And again, it's just a question in my own mind. Does it derogate from Christ and his infinite superiority with respect to Adam if we posit that Adam was immortal? Because it is Christ who is the author of life. He is the life-giving spirit. He is the prince of life. And again, taking up a thought that Mr. Stowe provided more than once, I think, with respect to the story of the Garden of Eden, and the tree of life is representing Christ. Would it not have been that Adam needed to partake of the tree of life, Christ, in order to become immortal? I don't know. I don't know the answer to these things, but it does seem to me as though that question is relevant in relation to that series of parallel statements that are made in 1 Corinthians 15, and the stress there that the natural comes first and then the spiritual. Now, I know that one could carry this too far, but it is an interesting principle that is always present in Scripture, that God introduces what is temporary and imperfect before he introduces what is permanent and perfect. You can see this in so many different ways. Saul, for example, David, law before, or the dispensation of the law, gospel, old covenant before new covenant, Adam before Christ. And, you know, whether one can extend that in any way to think, this relates to what Ian McKenzie was saying earlier about what we mean by perfect, we haven't defined perfect, whether there's a sense in which the first creation was in essence temporary. Now I just invite you to think, you see, that if you had a perfect world in the full sense, then it would have been incapable of falling. Because that is what the new creation will be. It will be incapable of falling. Otherwise our confidence is completely gone. If there's any possibility of a repetition of what has happened, then our confidence must be completely sound. So that, in fact, that it was intrinsic to the first order that it was capable of falling. And therefore, to that extent, was not perfect in an absolute sense. And I can see it too in questions of geology. I mean, there are so many imperfect things. If you take beautiful crystals and minerals, very, very rarely do you find them developed to that full degree of perfection. So often conditions of growth, impurities and other things have marred them from what they could have been. And that's again something that I as a scientist have to reckon with about the nature of the world. Well, I'm going to leave it there and leave it to someone else to take it up.
Dr. Fraser, you suggested that the possibility of mutation suggested that perfection is not possible. Boston and others said that Adam was created perfect but mutable. Surely the two are not incompatible.
That's related to original righteousness or original innocence, isn't it?
There's another double meaning of the word perfect. It can mean without flaw, but it can also mean finished.
Yes.
Well, again, it comes back to the question of how we define our terms.
Well, Adam could have been flawless, but unfinished.
Mm-hmm. Also, you said about the natural preceding the spiritual. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean to say that what was natural was flawless.
Well, I didn't mean to say that.
No, but, you know, the inference could have been drawn from that.
Yes, right.
And in the sort of nature of things, we're not told, as C.S. Lewis said, what might have been. But would it not have been possible that Adam, having been created a natural man, had, as we might say, a term of probation to fulfill, to eat of the tree of life, before he would then become a spiritual being, as in the nature of things we trust will happen at the end.
I think that's right.
The problem seems to me to be that if Adam was not immortal, and I mean we aren't suggesting that he had inherent immortality, but he had derived immortality from God, if he was not immortal, at least if he was not in the state where he would not proceed to die without being cursed, then what is the significance of God saying to him, if you eat the fruit, you will die? It seems to me that the statement has no significance unless Adam believes, and it is the case, that otherwise he will not die. And this seems to me to be one of the cruxes of the problem.
Unless it meant if you fulfill a period of probation without eating the fruit, you will not die.
But that isn't what it says.
Would have had to have been completed with
the condition is on the other side. It is, you will, the implication is, you will live. If you eat this, you will die. And that is different from the alternative condition, that if you don't eat this, you will live.
You said that's very important. It wasn't an inherent immortality, it was derived from God. Now, if the immortality was derived from God, gifted from God, would such a thing have been gifted before the period of probation was ended? Which it never was.
That's a matter of how you define your terms. Obviously, something is only immortal in the ultimate sense if it lives forever. The point is that Adam was not subject to death. I mean, I can't escape the fact that throughout the scriptures, death is said to be the consequence of sin. Where there is no sin, there is no death.
Well, I accept that, Nigel. It's just that the Puritan brothers were always insistent that although such a thing was true, that the sin was the cause of death, nonetheless, Adam did not deserve immortality by the very fact of his creation. Anything that he was given in the way of immortality was purely a gift from God. And even if he had continued without sin, he would not thereby have earned immortality.
I wouldn't disagree with you.
It's a gift from God.
Mm-hmm. It's also the fact that it's in the days that thou eat thereof, thou shalt die, which meant that the very moment he ate the fruit, in some way Adam was dead, apart from physical. But can I bring up another matter?
Well, don't bring that up and then run away from us.
Can I answer that briefly? I mean, as I understand, I mean the Hebrew construction bayom, I think, it really means just at the time or when. And the point is that then it is that Adam comes under the curse, and he is cursed and he begins to die. And as you see throughout Genesis, the patriarchs begin to die sooner and sooner and sooner, until you get 70 years and 10 rather than 942 or whatever we start off with. Do you want to make the second point?
Well, it's just, you mentioned something about the gates of paradise. There's this question of evil, and I'm trying to distinguish between the evil in the world and the sin of the world. Mr. Still several times tried to bring in the matter of the previous fall of the angels. Now, this is cutting across some of the things I think the world. One of you said that I do believe that the Satan, whatever he was called, that it was the prince of this world from the beginning, that somehow or other from the beginning he was tied up with this world, that he fell. And I've always had the idea for a long time anyway, that all the prehistoric death and misery that we seem to see in the fossils and so on was the evil that the devil brought into the world, which was not sin, because animals don't sin, but it was a curse. And then God later created Adam, but he created him in a perfect environment. After all, he had a garden made. And it's obvious in chapter 2 that Adam was in that garden from the moment he was created. God made the garden and put Adam there, so that he would have a portion of the world that was perfect. so that he was not a fallen being. He was not created as part of a fallen world. The fallen world's allowed to intrude because of the basic being has to come and so on. And then Adam is cast out. That's putting it very crudely, I know. But to me, that to some extent, this just in some highly well, there's a lot of death in the world, apparently, according to the Jobbers, before man appeared.
The difficulty seems to me to be that the scriptures do not attribute that death and decay except to man. And I mean, Romans 8, 19-20 seems to me to be a definite and clear statement, even though it's a bit confused the way it puts it. The creation was subjected to frustration or futility or whatever your translation has, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be liberated. And the commentators seem to agree, and people like Cranfield, I think, certainly say, that this can only mean a reference to the fall of man and to Genesis chapter 3, and that the subjection of the subhuman creation, as Paul means here, the creation apart from man, the animals and the plants and all the rest of it, that this subjection was caused by God, who subjected it when Adam fell. And the commentators would seem to agree that that is the way to interpret this passage. And I mean, if that's what it means, it seems to me that you can't try and short circuit the thing by bringing the devil in before the fall of Adam.
I think there are two questions that I would want to raise in this context. The first one relates directly to what Nigel has said, and I want to know why it is the commentators identify this passage inevitably in time with the fall of man, when the passage itself, as far as I can see, gives no indication at all that that link is there. The link in the passage is God in his sovereignty subjecting nature to something in hope, not in hope in relation to a fall, but hope in relation to an ultimate redemption of man. And I still want to know why it is inadmissible to think of God subjecting nature before man came on the scene to something that he knew he would accomplish later on through man's fall and redemption. So that's the first question. I would like to know why the commentators identify this so inevitably with the fall. The second question...
Why not let him answer the first one? Or you will have better than
mine. This is a question for me.
Well, anyone. I'll start off information.
I think my answer will be twofold. The commentators do this on exegetical grounds, principally because this is the only construction that can be placed on it in the context of Paul's argument in Romans. And this is Romans 8, and Romans 5 isn't far behind. And Paul has a very close structure of argument in which Adam and Christ are his principal characters. And it's an inevitable to see this as being a reflection on Genesis 3 and on the curse of the subhuman creation, which you find in Genesis 3, because there's no evidence that it means that something in particular else. And secondly, because I think there is some background to this in the rabbinic literature, which would make good sense of it in terms of Paul's own converse, because the rabbis were much exercised with the effects of the fall, and they interpreted it in a way which you couldn't have argued with against the New Testament interpretation, because they were really quite definite that, you know, the fall of Adam brought death into the world, and I mean they would have gone all the way with Milton, were unequivocal in their interpretation. And I think that the context of Romans puts Paul within their framework, and that's, I think, why the commentators would say that. I think it's a consensus view. I may be wrong here.
I don't know why you bring this. I don't think you need this to your argument. I'm astonished at you.
Are you? I didn't bring it in because it was vital to my argument. I brought it in simply because I wanted to know the grounds. I mean, as a theological layman, I constantly read commentaries which say this means so and so, and with my perpetually suspicious mind I say, why should it mean that? Why should I accept what you say when it doesn't appear to me to be saying what you say it says? Why do you say that it's... You're astonished that I should bring
it in. The creation was subjected to frustration, says the NIV.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, is it... can you do other than relate that to the fall? In the context before and after?
Well, I mean, this was Nigel's answer, and I'm prepared to accept it now in a way that I wasn't, perhaps was not before.
What do you think, man? I need advance notice of that. Well, I don't know. I think that I have to say that, except that notice that the emphasis is placed on who subjected the creation to futility.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that is a sovereign act of the Creator. And it is in terms of suffering working glory, which is another of the great Gilkenston themes, of course, isn't it, as well? In other words, the frustration and our suffering that goes along with that is for a very positive, high and wonderful purpose, namely glory. Indeed, there is this intrinsic connection. And the one who was the pioneer of our salvation, it was necessary for him to be made perfect through sufferings. And the attachment of sufferings and glory. And I mean, there is a sense in which we could say that therefore suffering has good in it. It has a very good and positive purpose in view.
Kleins is writing on that. But where is he writing on that just now? Is it the third way or the...
Yeah.
Kleins, the Old Testament scholar. On the... What's the term he uses? Not the good effect, something of sin.
No, the necessity of sin.
Yes.
Absolutely
astonishing.
Yes, I wouldn't like to... Well, I wouldn't like to make that
any sense. No, it's one. Mm. Have you read that?
I haven't, no, but I've read some of his other things on the same subject.
Yes.
Having suggested, Mr. Stroll, that Rawlins put his questions one at a time, I think we should ask him to give the second one.
I think it's a little there.
Very briefly, just in Romans, in chapter 20 of Romans 8, when it says the creation was subjected to frustration, I think it's an aorist. And it certainly implies that there was creation before there was frustration. And that, it seems to me, is the keystone of the argument I'm trying to put forward. That there was something before this evil came into it. And I think that is very significant. And it's certainly implied by this particular verse. It was there and something happened to it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Roland?
Something happened in the garden, and I'm not sure that the garden is necessarily different from the rest of creation, and if so, why was a garden necessary in a perfectly good creation? But there, before Adam sinned, you have gotten to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and also the tree of life. I'm still a bit confused about the immortality or otherwise of Adam. You have the tree of good and evil, you have also the tree of life. And then we're talking now about something happening to creation, and I've got them all mixed up and I've got some of the solution.
It's the kind of question which requires a commentary in response to it, I think. I'm not sure where to begin. It seems to me that the context of Genesis 1 to 3 is juridical. Its structure is juridical. It's a sort of court scene. And God is being exculpated from being responsible for the consequences of Genesis chapter 3 by the way that chapter 1 explains the goodness of the creation. The garden, it seems to me, is simply an extra emphasis on God's provision for man. He didn't just make him a good, perfect world to live in. He even made a garden in it. I mean, the world was wild. You know, there would have been stuff all over the place. But here was an ordered garden made in an already perfect world. There's the emphasis, you see, things piled on, you see, and the woman is made for him. And everything is laid on. There's no reason at all why this man should sin.
Yes.
Because everything was going for him. And then you have the sin and you have the structure of the thing. God comes and finds him and he is arraigned and he is tried and he is found guilty. And I think that's a structure. And you should look at the details in the context of the structure. And so, I mean, who knows what exactly is meant by the two trees? It is very difficult to see. And certainly we can see a little. I mean, the tree of life certainly pointed forward to Revelation and to Christ, obviously. And I don't at all doubt that the redemption was in the mind of God when he created. But I think that is different from saying that God therefore made a creation already in need of redemption, which to me creates enormous problems in the doctrine of God apart from anything else. And completely sells out to Hick and people who want to completely revise the Christian theology. And the tree of life points forward. That he is expelled from the garden until one reason is given so that he won't eat from this tree, and the implication seems to be that one eating of the tree would restore him to life. The way the wording is something like, lest he take also of the tree of life, as he has taken implication of the tree as a knowledge of good and evil. And the implication is that one bite is going to be enough to restore him. And that is basically why I don't think that eating of that tree continually was necessary to stave off mortality. The implication of the bit about leaving the garden is that one eating, comparable with the eating of the tree of the other tree, would have been enough to restore the status quo.
Makes clear that there must be two completely different ideas underlying the word death in Genesis 3. And this is one I think we really want to worry out very, very closely to understand it, because I think without the definition or clear distinction of these two things, we go around in circles. If the Adam having eaten of the one tree is considered that day, and I would take it that the Hebrew phrase there means, literally what it says, that he shall die, then he is dead towards God in some sense. He is not therefore dead in a physical sense. And what the sentence of God in the story of man from the tree of life seems to suggest is that if he were in the state of being dead to God to eat and be immortal, then there could be no salvation for him. That's the conclusion. So there are obviously two ideas of death here. I think this is very important, because if we are going to read one idea of death only in Romans 8 and say that that refers to Paul, then what we are doing is excluding the idea of death prior to the fall, that is to say, in geological terms. The trilobites that stand in my son's bookshelf, supposedly 200 million years old, they have not, in some sense, passed through death, if we were to exclude death in the physical sense prior to the fall.
I'm not contesting anything about the death of animals or the death of plants. I hold no brief for plants and animals' death. And I regard that, I mean, in Genesis 1, it commands the eating of vegetation. And that implies the vegetation will die. And that is not contested. Can I briefly respond to thing about the trees? But I think it's wrong to think that there's more than one idea of death in the Bible. Particularly in Romans. and in Genesis. I think Romans should govern our interpretation of Genesis, and I think that in Paul's thought, and I think there's scholarly agreement about this, Paul does not work with different ideas of death. He works with a single idea of death, which encompasses what we would call a theological and biological and so on, moral ideas of death. And that in Paul's mind there is no real distinction, that the things operate in a sense dependently on each other within a given life, and that people can live physically while they're dead spiritually and so on and so forth. But there's an organic notion of death which Paul expounds, and it seems to me is faithful to the Old Testament in so doing. And that is what we find in Genesis 3. Adam is cursed with this idea of death, which includes physical death, 900 and odd years later, depending just how long he'd lived before he fell. It includes spiritual death, which of course came immediately. And it included increasing moral degradation for the race, which goes on down to the flood. And I mean, the fact that Genesis 5 is principally variation on the theme, and he died after a given period of years, seems to me to indicate beyond cavil that physical death is an essential ingredient in the death spoken of in Genesis 3, and that there is more to it than that, but there's no less to it than that, and the things all hang together.
Would it not be the case on this basis that the process of the death of cells in the human body would have begun at the fall, in these terms, the death and non-replacement?
That sounds to me very likely. I mean, certainly death and non-replacement. I mean, as I understand it from my medical friends, there is no reason why the body need die, why it need age. It's just that it does. And the thing could well work differently. And I mean, you have things like these great trees in the States, you know, which have lived for 4,000 years, and they only really die if there's an earthquake. The things just carry on. And there's no intrinsic reason, it seems to my friends who know about these things, why that shouldn't have been the case with man.
Except that it's very, very unusual.
Except that it's very, yes. But the principle is there. And you know, the idea that Adam could have been dying, and of course we are dying from when we're born, certainly we're dying from when we reach maturity, we are, because we are under the curse.
You were assenting to what you were saying earlier. What do you mean by that?
Well, I certainly, I must confess that I would agree that whenever I've read Romans 5, that I've always taken death to include physical death. And to that extent, I think that I would largely go along with what Nigel has said, even though it does, in fact, create more problems for me in other areas. Perhaps it's interesting just to recall something that I read of 19th century writers. Again, this Edward Hitchcock had explored this in quite some considerable detail. And basically his position was this, but I'm going to add to it, you know, just to give, you know, what could be a possible position to hold, although I wouldn't necessarily say I held it myself. But if we think of Adam being created naturally mortal, but he passed into immortality when he died, that is to say, that if his you know, death was simply like going into a sleep from which he immediately arose in a new and elevated and immortal experience, and death would simply not be what we know it to be. We simply would not know death in that way. Now the point, therefore,
you need to say that again. Because that's the point at which you contradict yourself just flatly.
Did I?
You better come and play the tape back.
I can't remember the words, but you took it up, David. David. Yes. Did you notice you said that?
Well, if in fact death in that sense was necessary for him to pass, if you like, from the natural to the spiritual, all right? Yeah, something like that.
What? See?
Yes.
Remember, this has been speak up, it's being recorded. It's all being recorded.
James Bay is the gateway to eternal life, that's apart from a fall.
Yes,
yes. Yes, apart from a fall. Oh, yes, apart from a fall.
What about Enoch?
It would be like Enoch.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been our death, it would have been like Enoch.
Yes, that's right.
Who was not, for God took it.
Yes, that's right. And therefore, death would simply not mean anything of what it does mean. And therefore, death has two components. There is a very, very major aggravation of the physical aspect, in that it involves suffering, anticipation, and all this kind of thing. But much more important, there is the tremendous fear, isn't there, of being separated from God himself. You see, that is the spiritual dimension of death, that this the Bible then does indeed speak about the second death in terms of eternal separation from God, and that is what makes death have its tremendous terrors for us. And if we think of the fall in these two senses of very greatly aggravating the physical aspects of physical death, and also the spiritual dimension, then I think we can see how the Bible can speak of death as the last enemy and the great terror from it. And something of which, of course, he's not only intensely afraid, but also intensely ashamed. I don't know. As I say, I'm not necessarily holding to that view myself. But it is a possible reading, I think. And it was certainly one of this Hitchcock man. He was a theologian, but also a very competent geologist, saying. I would be interested to know what Nigel has, if there's any comments on that.
Yes, I mean, I've come across the idea before. It seems to me the basic problem with it is it's a very speculative notion, which goes against the obvious reading of Scripture. Because in Scripture, we clearly assume that what we read refers to events with which we are familiar. And when we see people speaking about death, we assume, not unreasonably, that it is speaking about the experience analogous with death today. And that therefore when Adam is threatened with death, he is being threatened with what we know to be death, and what evidently death meant from Genesis 4 onwards, rather than with something different from that. And so I wonder whether there is, what the meaning is in suggesting that this could be a reading. I mean, whether one isn't going into a sort of private area of speculation, which has no longer any contact with the text. And of course, the death of Christ, you see, I mean, is the key. And the death of Christ was simply a physical death. And it was a simple physical part of it, which, I mean, of course, there was so much more to it than that, but it was on this the whole thing hinged. I don't doubt that there may have been some kind of translation or something intended for Adam, ultimately. I don't believe necessarily he would have lived on the earth indefinitely. But the Bible seems to suggest that it's the thing that we call death, which is what he was threatened with, and which he wouldn't have had to go through.
I wonder if you think of the relationship of the effect that the fall had on the nature of time. It seems to me that time is really the essence of what we're speaking of. What is death and decay? It is change over a time base. Time ticks out death and decay for us. Now, time is an exceedingly difficult thing to get a hold of. And in Bailey, we were talking that something happened before something else. One of the great benefits of relativity theory in this century has been to point our minds away from the common sense notion of time, which is an absolute constant for everybody, to the idea that in fact time is really a very much more particular and relative thing, that my time is not the same as somebody else's time. Try and particularize that the wristwatch in my hand does not necessarily see the same time as the wristwatch in somebody else.